If I get a call, shall I answer it? I don't know whose phone this is. My name is Palmer Grace. I am a grateful member of Al-Anon. And I want to thank you for allowing me to come and be a part of this conference. What a privilege to be here. I love AA and Al-Anon in Georgia. You guys do it right. Now, thank you for your service. The signers, they asked us to read and speak a little slowly, and I speak Southern, so I'll probably be slow enough here. My home group is the Kendall Stepping Up Group in Miami, Florida. And if you're in Miami, call me, and we'd love for you to come in. I also have an open AA committed meeting I go to every week at Sable Palm in Miami. And yes, we've got somebody from Sable. Thank you, Valerie. I loved seeing Valerie walk in, and I'm not going to speak from notes, so please don't get upset. But I do want to make sure that I want to thank everybody, that I thank the committee. It really is an honor to be here and a privilege, and it is astounding that Alcoholics Anonymous allows us to share their podium, and thank you for that. I owe my life to Alcoholics Anonymous. You reached out and pulled me in and loved me and saved me, and for that I can never repay the debt. All I can do is say yes when I'm asked. And so thank you for allowing us to be here with you. And Barbara. I love Barbara. She and I share the same grand sponsor, and Anna. It is such a thrill to see you again, and we spent time in Chicago, and Emily, and there's so many. I mean, you know, I come from Miami to here, and I'm among friends, and literally Tanju is here. I love Tanju, and Vibeka was down here, and Sherry, my Cornhusker friend, we share a. I'm a Sooner from Oklahoma, really. So, and you'd think that we wouldn't get along, but you know, we're people who would not normally mix. But she and I, you know, we discuss football with love, and that's really neat. So, and Baron, thank you so much for, you know, he came and got me at the airport, and watching two Al-Anons get lost is just a hoot. I'd love to have been a fly in the back of here. He was saying, I think we go this way. And so I got my phone out, you know, of course. And I was going to take us downtown Atlanta to a Marriott down there. And finally he got the brilliant idea. I don't know where this comes from to stop and ask for help. What a thought. So when I was new in the program, my sponsor made me read page 132 in the big book every day for 30 days. And in that it says, we are not a glum lot. We absolutely insist on enjoying life. And I couldn't figure out, why is he having me read this page? Why do I have to read this page? And after about a week, I started to kind of lighten up and see, I dearly love that page now, and I love the laughter and what we do here. I mean, it is just so much fun to be in recovery. I came into this fellowship March 5th of 1990. I am so grateful for that time, and my family is grateful. Everybody in my family. I have a friend who speaks, and she says she's never. Nobody ever stopped her at the door and says, don't go to a meeting today, please, you know. They don't stop me at the door either, you know. They're encouraging me. I think even my dog encourages me to go to Al-Anon. So. I don't know how I got to Al-Anon, you know. I was brought up in a home that I was loved. I wasn't supposed to be born, but it's not that it was an accident, but my parents were brilliant physicists, and they were part of the Manhattan Project. And I mean, when I say brilliant, I mean they were brilliant, and Dad had a radiation accident, and I wasn't supposed to be born, but I was. And they loved me and took care of me. I have two sisters, and they loved me. And you know, that's not the message I heard. I have a disease of perception. And so what I heard was, I'm no damn good. I'm the stupid one in the family. My sister was brilliant. You know, my parents were brilliant. I'd go to school and my teachers would say, why can't you be like her? Well, I couldn't, you know, I couldn't. So I said, screw it, you know, I was the class clown. The interesting thing is that I heard that message of why can't you be like her. None of them ever said it. It's going on in my brain, my mind. I hear people all the, often in AA say, well, it's the Al-Anon that remembers what goes on because we were in a blackout. It's not my experience because, you see, I have this perceiver that is looking out there and everything that I see is run through that filter, and so I don't know that I'm looking at the truth. And so I grew up, I was just absolutely uncomfortable in my own skin. I didn't, I just couldn't be around you. I don't know what it was. I just couldn't be around you. And I didn't know how to do anything. And it was as if that the week I was supposed to be born, you know, God gathered all of us up and had the pre-birthing meeting and said, and I had to go to the bathroom. So I went to the bathroom and came back. And he said, and that's everything you need to know while you're on earth. I missed the instruction set. And so I'm going through life trying to figure out how to fit in. And I'm like Beth, I can't talk to you. You know, and after I say, you know, hi, my name's Palmer, I'm done. I don't know what else to say. I can't carry on a conversation with two people because I'm just steeped in fear. I mean, I'm just filled with fear, and I didn't know what to do. You know, I hear my friends talk, you know. I waited until I was 12 to really get rip-roaring drunk. And, this is an Al-Anon speaker, but, some friends of mine were gathered. We were having a party in my basement, you know. We were hiding from my mom, and somebody handed me a Colt 45 malt liquor, and so I took that one and another one, and I just got terribly drunk and throwing up and the projectile vomiting kind of thing. And yet the magic didn't happen. I know for those of you in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, that my friends tell me that you can work through that to get to the good stuff. But it didn't work for me. You know, I didn't get that magic feeling of my shoulders coming down off my ears and that relaxing moment of it's okay. I just got sick and had to go to church the next morning hungover, and it wasn't a good feeling, you know. So I share with the alcoholic that feeling of I just can't fit in my own skin, but I don't have the solution to that in the bottle. And you know, it was just, I mean, oh God, it was a miserable time growing up in high school. You know, I remember nobody liked me, and I knew that to be true, and yet again I'm running it through my perceiver. I mean, I went to, I guess it was my 25th class reunion, and I was talking to some people, and this one guy said, oh yeah, you were always one of the popular kids in class. And I'm, who are you talking to? I mean, you know, it's my perception is broken, and my perceiver is warped. And so, you know, I hear Sandy Beach talk often about how we need to, you know, we can change our story. And I can change my story, and I have, because, you know, what I heard was just not right. I left high school, and, you know, I couldn't get far enough, fast enough away from home, because for me, something out there must be going to fix me. Something out there. I mean, you know, hope is just down the road. I know that if I go from New Mexico to Portland, Oregon, I'm going to be okay. So I moved into Portland and started into college. Now, this was the 70s, and we drank, and we did inhale, and I was a sophisticated kid. My friend got busted for pot. I knew what pot was. What I didn't understand is why he kept it in a jar top, a lid, you know. why don't you use a baggie or something? No. I was a kid from New Mexico. I didn't know anything, and I fell in with this crowd that were drinking and doing other outside stuff, you know, and I just fit right. I mean, I just fell in. And if they said, here, take this, I took that. I didn't ask. I never once remember asking, what is it? I just take it. Because, you know, if you were inviting me along for the ride, maybe I was going to be accepted and I would do anything to win your approval. It never worked. I never got their approval because, again, of this disease of perception. But so I lasted maybe 2 years in college, and then she left for Haight-Ashbury. I don't remember who she was, but she left for Haight-Ashbury, and so I left for Haight-Ashbury. I dropped out of college. I was a hippie, you know, flower child. I had long hair and a beard down here and put the flower, you know, you can find flowers put behind your ear. And I moved into Haight-Ashbury, and I was a hippie on the streets down there. But again, you know, anywhere I go, there I am. And so I got to Haight-Ashbury, and there were people doing heroin and speed, and it wasn't my thing. And so it was just not right. You know, something here is not right. I didn't realize it was inside of me. I was always blaming it on something out there. Something's wrong with you, therefore I don't fit. And so I left and went to a commune in New Mexico and moved back into a commune outside of Santa Fe and was living there. And that was really beautiful for a time, and then it wasn't working. And again, it was the it, and there was this wrong, and that was wrong, and so I got in the Volkswagen van and traveled across the country to Virginia Beach and lived there for a time. And while I was in New Mexico, my mom was dying of cancer. She was in the hospital, you know, my dad died when I was a kid, and mom was dying, I went down one day, and I said, Mom, I gotta go. I can't stay. I'm going to Virginia Beach. And I left. It says in the big book that self is self-centered, that we think is the root of our problem. I didn't see that I was being selfish and self-centered. I didn't know that I was walking off to leave her. I didn't know. All I knew was that there's something out there that must be where I will be okay. And I chased it to the gates of insanity and further. And you know, it's just, it's bizarre. I went out to Virginia Beach and the state police came looking for us. And that's not a good thing when you're out on the beach doing what hippies do. And they came and found me and said, you need to call home. And I called home. And my family was just coming in from the funeral. You know, my mama died, and I wasn't there. I wasn't a son. I wasn't a brother. I wasn't a nephew. I wasn't there. And I wasn't there because of my disease. I was self-centered, out looking for something anywhere that would fix me. And this will come up in my story because, you know, I carried that around. I had to make amends for that. But at the time, I moved back to Los Alamos, and I was taking care of the house, and I was living in the house and selling stuff and taking care of it. I tell my story this way because, you know, I've not mentioned alcoholism. The only person that had really gotten drunk is me. I'm crazy as a loon. You can tell that. I'm crazy. And so, you know, I hear people say often in Al-Anon, my qualifier. You know, I'm convinced and have become convinced that I am my qualifier. I marry alcoholic women because I qualify for Al-Anon. I don't qualify for Al-Anon because I marry alcoholic women. And I find the solution. I suffer from a spiritual malady that I find the solution here in this program. And you've given it to me. I was playing music in a coffee house, and one night I was out on the mesa just praying or something. I don't know what I was doing, but I don't fit. I just don't understand. Would you give me the wisdom to understand what it is that's going on? So I was playing that night in the coffee house, and God's got this wonderful sense of humor. In walked an alcoholic, you know, and then I was playing a set, and boy, she got my attention. I played two more songs, and I went and sat down with her and then started talking. You know, we began this courtship, and we moved in together 5 minutes later, 16 years, you know. My grand sponsor, Vinoy, says after 5 minutes, you know everything you need to know. Why wait? We didn't wait, you know. We were running off into the sunset to find the solution somewhere else. And my wife, the incumbent, likes me to say that I've been married twice, that she didn't do any of this, that this was my first wife. So, but anyway, we moved off to Oregon again, and we cut the lodge poles and set up my teepee and lived on the side of Mount Hood, and it was beautiful. I mean, it was an idyllic time, and I loved that. And she was working for me, because when I met her, I felt the power go down to my fingertips. I was okay in my own skin for the first time in my life. And I'd never experienced that feeling of just being okay. And I got that from her. You know, just being with her gave me that. And so Dr. Silkworth talks about that feeling of ease and comfort that comes from taking in what he says is a few drinks. For me, I experienced that sense of ease and comfort from taking of her. And so we ran off into the sunset. And it lasted for maybe 3-4 weeks, you know. But everywhere I go, there I am. And so I started getting uncomfortable and feeling like there's got to be something else. So instead of just uprooting me, I started pulling her out too. And so we moved over to Eastern Oregon in this mansion that had been used as a cow barn and didn't have running water and had outside plumbing. And I thought it was a mansion. So we were living there. And my sister-in-law came to stay with us, and she dropped her kids off. And she went downtown Redmond, Oregon, and began drinking herself to death. And I didn't understand. It's bewildering to watch an alcoholic drink themselves to death. And I didn't understand. I've been around alcohol. My parents drank. But they'd buy a case of scotch, and it would last for a year. It'd only be, you know, parties and one drink. And you know, they didn't abuse alcohol. I didn't understand drinking like this. And so it's bewildering for the family. And I watched Bobby Joe, and I just didn't understand. One Sunday, her kids were with her that Sunday, and she was bleeding out of a slit wrist on the streets of Redmond, Oregon, and her kids were screaming and running around, and I didn't understand. I didn't understand that it was alcoholism that was that she was bleeding from it. And so I took her to the hospital, and we patched her up, and shortly thereafter I took her to Bend, Oregon, to a detox center. There weren't treatment centers. It was like a jitter joint. They put her in the chair or in the bed and let her shake it out. And I had my first introduction to you. You know, they had these half sentences on the wall of live and let live. Easy does it. I mean, easy does what? You know, it's like... there but for the grace, you know, it didn't look to me like very much grace being strapped to a gurney in this detox center shaken, but I did see you. Nobody told me about Al-Anon. I mean, it was existing. This was 1974, but I got my introduction to the big book, because when Bobby Joe came out, she and I would sit down and she'd read from the book, and I would listen and read from it, and she gave me a copy for a while of the second edition of the big book. That was the one that was out at the time. And I read it, and it resonated with me, but I didn't have the problem. And if they told me to go to Al-Anon, I wouldn't know why, because she had the problem, not me. I wasn't ready yet. I wasn't done yet. So we stayed, and Bobby Joe sobered up, and I thought she did. Actually, she went back drinking again, but I didn't know that. We moved to Eastern Oklahoma, and we were living out on this farm. I bought a farm. I was going to drop out of society and live out on this farm. And I got my second brush with alcoholism. I was working with my father-in-law, and he was a really strong, neat guy from Texas and East Texas, and he trained cutting horses. So I was working with him training cutting horses, his understanding and empathy with animals was just amazing, and I'd work with him and watch that, and he disappeared, and I found him a couple months later in a flop house in Poto, Oklahoma, and he asked me to take him to detox, And I did, and he said, you know, as we were driving out of town, he said, buy me a beer. And I'm saying, man, I'm taking you to detox. Why am I going to buy you a beer? And he made me understand that, you know, there were bugs crawling on him, and he was seeing things that I didn't see, and the onset of DTs was coming, and he needed a beer to get from Poto to McAllister, a 45-minute drive. So I bought him a beer and took him to detox, and I again see these half sentences on the wall. And I saw people who were doing things that I didn't understand, but they were able to work with him and sober him up. So I kept living on the farm, and my wife started drinking a lot. And she started drugging a lot. And I didn't perceive that as a particular problem. I jumped in and did it too. I mean, you know, I love hanging out at Turkey Creek Saloon. That was my hole. And I'd go up and drink with them. Well, of course I would. You know, I didn't want to leave her up there by herself drinking. I'd go up there with her, and I found that she needed me more and more to go with her to the drinking hall because I needed to watch because there were things starting to happen, and she was doing stuff that I didn't understand again, and you know, when I the first time I read this pamphlet, it's an Al-Anon pamphlet, but it's a reprint of the chapter to wives. And also the family afterwards. But I was reading that pamphlet, and I hated that pamphlet. I mean, I hated it. The reason I thought I hated it was because it was it was antiquated. It was sexist. Didn't he know there were men living with alcoholics? And that's not why I hated it. The reason I hated it was because he had looked in my window, and he was describing my home, and you know, he's describing the affairs. The retaliatory affairs, the disappearing, all of the things, the despairing wives and the, in this case, the husband and I was good at that. I was really good at being pitiful Palmer. You know, I was like, people would say, "Are you okay?" I'm okay. I'm doing okay. And I'd get sympathy and parlay that into, things that I wasn't brought up to do, you know, and I bought and sold substances that not supposed to be bought and sold in the thought that maybe, just maybe, if I could do that, I could make her happy. And I could again retrieve that sense of ease and comfort that when I first met her, I had felt. So I'd go to the bar. I remember one time, you know, that she was going up to the bar to drink at Turkey Creek, and David Allen Coe was coming in. Some of you may know who David Allen Coe is. Outlaw country and western guy. And he drags in people on, the Harleys, your friends. And so I signed up as security so that I... Now, you got to understand, I'm a wimp. So, I mean, what am I going to do? Go up to this big biker in leather and say, "Oh, please, sir, would you put your gun down?" You know, it's like, I would put myself in situations because I knew, you know, I had to watch her. I could walk in the house and very quickly assess by the ashtrays and which ashtrays were used, where they had been, what they'd been doing, who was there. By the brand of cigarette. I mean, you know, we're great detectives. boy, are we good detectives, or at least we think we were. But I kept watching and seeing what it was she was doing, and I was losing control. And I couldn't make it better. And when I couldn't make it better, I was getting weirder and weirder, trying anything I could think of. I'd drink with her, I'd not drink with her. I'd drink wine, I wouldn't drink wine. Take a vacation, not take a vacation. I did it. No, we're not going on a vacation because you got drunk. Or, gee, honey, maybe we ought to go take a vacation. Maybe you'll feel better. You know, I would go to any lengths to try to make her happy. I didn't understand that I was being selfish and self-centered in my search because as I was trying to make her happy, I was trying to arrange the light, the ballet, the everything that was around me so that if she was okay, I'd be okay too. we isolate. We did, because, you know, I've got this need to look good to the neighbors. And if you know what's going on in my home, you're going to think less about me, less of me. You probably aren't thinking of me at all, but I didn't know that either. And we had one set of friends left, or we had a few, and this one set had asked us to come over and watch a movie one Friday night. And so we're going to go watch a movie, and the night came, and she said, I don't want to go, or I'm not feeling good, or something. She didn't want to go. And I said, well, I'll stay home too. And she said, no, you go. And so I went. And I don't remember what movie they were watching. It was Friday the 13th or some weird movie like that. And so I went, but I was just thinking about her. I was thinking, that's enough. But I was thinking about her. And so I left a little early and went home. And as I was walking up towards the house, a gun poked out, and she held a gun on me. She said, get the hell out. Don't you ever come back. And I was terrified. You know, alcoholism is terrifying. I didn't understand. I didn't know it was alcoholism poking out the door. I thought it was a gun. And so I ran off to Arkansas, and she got a lawyer, and she was going to divorce me. And I didn't understand. I mean, I just went to the movie. You said go. Her lawyer called me in, so I went in for a meeting, and my lawyer was going to come over. And when I got to the lawyer's office, she was there. And she said, Palmer, I don't know what came over me. I love you. I need you. Please come home. And for an Al-Anon, you know, that I need you is like a mainline shot for a junkie. You know, it's like, boom. I fired my lawyer on the spot. And I went home. Of course I would. She needs me. And so I went home. It doesn't ever get better. You know, once you get on this downhill slide of alcoholism, it is just downhill. There's no way out. But I went home. And you know, I got crazier and crazier. And my mother-in-law came down, you know, and she was the one married to the guy I took to detox. And she said, Palmer, is she drinking a lot, you know, or is she drugging? What's going on? And of course, again, that need to look good to the neighbor. No, Ma, she's not drinking. Everything is fine. Thank you very much. I decided that she said, you know, the reason that she was so crazy is that I was off to work all the time. And, you know, that's easy to fix. I quit my job. And I came home. But then, you know, I was home. I was home all the time. We were broke. And it still wasn't right. And so, you know, as once again, I'm trying to find a solution and trying anything I can think of to fix the problem, and that didn't work. It just kept getting weirder and more bizarre. And one day she went up to the lake. You know, she was going to go to a party, and so she took off in the car and went to the lake. And about dusk, I had no defense against the first think. I needed to know what she was doing and with whom she was doing it. And so I went, I'd gone on drive-by sightings before to the bar and everything, but I'd always had a car. This day I didn't have a car, so what do you do? Well, I jumped on my tractor and I went up over this mountain and down these hairpin turns to do a drive-by sighting to see where she was and with whom she was partying. And you know, that's crazy behavior. It was dangerous. It was night. There was no moonlight. And my tractor didn't have a muffler. And so I'm coming up on the lake. And I think I'm being sneaky, driving up on him. And so I got to the lake, and there was nobody there. Now, I don't know. They may have been hiding out in the weeds just laughing at this maniac coming up on a loud tractor sneaking in. Or maybe they were gone. Maybe she was never there. I don't know. But I thought, it's okay. They're gone. So I got back on my tractor up over these hairpin turns and down the mountain to drive home. It never occurred to me. Well, she isn't home either. I just had taken care of that urge, that first think, and had done it. You know, I had no defense against that. I was just on my tractor going up into doing that. And I didn't know what was going on. You know, I was always doing crazy things, and I didn't know that I was being crazy. If you really just understood, you'd see I was just trying to help her, just help her. I was speaking one time at a conference, and this guy came up afterwards, you know, the hug the speaker line kind of thing, and he said, "Yeah, I know, I can relate. I had a stalker too," and I wanted to just say, you know, "No, I wasn't a stalker. I was just..." But, you know, I was, you know. And so it just got crazier and crazier. My mother-in-law came down again and she said, "Palmer, is she drinking? She's acting really weird. You're acting weird." Our ODAT says that it's sometimes easier to recognize an alcoholic home by the actions of the family than it is the alcoholic. And my mother-in-law was saying, "You're acting bizarre. What's going on?" And I said, "Well, nothing." And again, you know, I've got to look good to the neighbors. In fact, that when I'd come home to the gun, she had borrowed that gun from my other friend down the road, and I had to take the gun back to him and describe why she'd borrowed the gun to run me off to Arkansas. You can't admit alcoholism. So I said, "Well, Jack, you know, I think she suffers from PMS you know, PMS maybe is a higher order disorder than alcoholism. I don't know, but it seemed I could lay it off to that. I've got to look good to the neighbors." And my mother-in-law, when she came down, she said, "Palmer, I want to tell you a story. There was a lady who lived with a bad drunk, and she tried everything that she could do to make him sober up and not drink. And one day she went in and talked to her husband and said, 'Honey, is there anything that I can do that will make you stop drinking?' And he said, 'You know, I believe that if you would go out and dig a dozen worms, fry them up, I could eat those worms and I could stop drinking.' Well, we'll do anything." So she went out and lovingly dug a dozen worms, brought them in, breaded them, fried them, laid them out beautifully on a platter and brought them in to him. And he said, "Cut them in half, you eat half, and I'll eat the other half and stop drinking." We'll go to any lengths, of course. So she cut them in half and she ate half. He went and got a bottle of bourbon and proceeded to get drunk. And she's going, "Why? Why? I mean, I dug the worms, I ate the worms, I've done everything you asked, and you're drinking." He said, "Yeah, you ate the wrong half." That was a moment for me. I could see that I always ate the wrong half. Everything I ever tried to stop her from drinking, it was the wrong thing to do. And I could see that in her story, that I'm absolutely powerless over alcohol. She said, "Palmer, you've got to go to Al-Anon. There is a program for you. You've got to go to Al-Anon." I wasn't out of plans yet. So I had newcomer plans at the time. I decided that if I could just go to school, I had a high school education, that's all. If I could go get my teaching certificate, I could get a job right by the farm. I know some of your teachers, please understand, I was ignorant, but my thought was that, well, teachers only work from like 10 to 2, and then they get their summers off, and it's an easy gig, and I could do that. I'm a teacher now, I know that's not true, but that's what I thought. So I began this commute to the University of Oklahoma. It's a 3-hour drive. I'd go up 3 hours, leave 4:00 in the morning, Monday morning, and I'd come back Thursday or Friday, depending on my course schedule. And I was going to get a teaching certificate and come home where I could be home and work. And it, you know, things just got worse and worse. I'd drive home on the weekends and, you know, I was so obsessed with her that I wouldn't know where I was. I mean, I could drive for an hour and a half and I would not have any memory of the drive. That was my Al-Anon brownout. It comes from the obsession of the mind. You know, I was so obsessed with her that I didn't, I'm lucky I didn't kill somebody because I was so obsessed with thinking about her. And when I first came to Al-Anon, they told me that she was like a starfish. You know, anywhere I look, there she is. And one Thursday night, we got in this just brutal, wicked fight over the telephone. And I mean, as only can I think happen in an alcoholic home, an active alcoholism home, and I just didn't know what to do. I was just at the end. I didn't know. And so Mom's words had come back. You've got to go to Al-Anon. So I was blubbering and calling, you know, crying and looked up in the phone book, and I couldn't find Al-Anon in the phone book. Probably I couldn't spell it. I found AA. It's easier to spell. And I called. I am so grateful for this group where they believe strongly in family recovery. And in this one group, they had many, many rooms, and the Al-Anon met in one, the Al-Ateen, the Al-Dog, Al-Cat, Al-Tot, and I mean, it was everything. Separate meetings, but just one fellowship, and we fellowshiped together. And so when I called and I was blubbering and crying, they said, I think we can help you. Here, talk to this woman. And so I talked to her. They handed the phone to an Al-Anon, and she listened to me very kindly for a while, and she said, Palmer, I think we can help you. Come in. They met on Sunday, Monday, and Wednesday at that group. And this was Thursday. I was going to the farm. So Monday, March 5th of 1990, I walked into my first Al-Anon meeting. And it was just magical. I mean, I was home. I don't know any other way to say it, but I was home. And I didn't hear much of what they said. I just heard that the three C's, I didn't cause it, can't cure it, and can't control it. That was so magical for me because I had heard for years that she drank because I, and then you fill in the blank, it was the raison d'être. I don't know what the reason was. If she said you do A, I'd do A, and then she'd go drink because I didn't do B. And if I do B, she'd drink because I didn't do A. I mean, it didn't matter what I did. It was always the wrong thing, and I thought I caused it. She told me I caused it. We went to marriage counseling. They call it couples therapy now, I understand. But we went there, and he said I caused it. I believe that I caused her to drink, and you guys told me no. She drinks because she suffers from a condition of alcoholism, and that's what alcoholics do. And they started talking about that disease and the phenomenon of craving and all of this stuff that was just amazing to me, but what I heard mostly was, I didn't cause it. I wasn't why she did what she did. They didn't leave it there. They said, well, but you do have parts in it, and you know, there's stuff you can do. They said, Palmer, you don't have to live this way anymore if you don't want to. There's a solution for you here. We don't know what's going to happen with her, but there's hope for you. And I just grabbed onto that. And I went to meetings every time the door opened, I was there. And I just sat with you because I was safe, I was comfortable, and I was with you. And these old women, I mean, you know, there was all women in Al-Anon. No, that's not true, but it was my perception. And they were old, which was also my perception. They're probably 10 years younger than I am now, but but they would hug me at the door and greet me and say, we're glad you're here. And I am forever grateful for that. And that was not an easy thing because when I came in the door, I looked like Charlie Manson. I did. I had, you know, my hair and my beard down here and scraggly hair. It was dirty. I stunk. I was not a pretty picture. And yet they met me at the door and hugged me and said, we're glad you're here. Please come back. We need you. Oh, well, if they need me, you know, I'm here. I'm so grateful for them. And then after a short time, I got this feeling of terminal uniqueness. You know, my case is different. You don't understand. I'm a guy in Al-Anon, and you're women. You don't understand. And one of these old women pulled me aside and put two fingers in my chest and said, "Palmer, listen for similarities, not differences." And I did. And I started hearing that what I suffer from is the family disease of alcoholism. And I'm convinced that it is a family disease. And that they were taking care of me. And they were starting to teach me. And I was reading things in the book that just, it just touched my soul. I still don't know that lady is an alcoholic. She's never come to say that she's an alcoholic. But I know that I was home, and that's what's important. She hated me going to Al-Anon. She would often tell me, "If you go to Al-Anon one more time, I will do this," and whatever this was, it was never pretty. It threatened her that I was going to Al-Anon, and I had just enough sense to keep going because I desperately needed what you had, and I'm so grateful that I did. I kept coming for about 2.5 months, and then I was home one weekend, and you know, these people, I kept asking, I said, "Do I stay? Do I go? Do I go? Do I stay? What do I do?" And they said, "Palmer, when you know, you'll know, so don't worry about it." I'm going, "When I know, I'll know what? What are you talking about?" You know, they talk in these riddles here, and and so I was home. And she was just, I don't know what was wrong with her, but she was screaming at me, holding this butcher knife, and she said, "When you go to sleep, you're a dead man." And I was on a cot, and I was at such a point of despair that I didn't care. I just rolled over and went to sleep. I realized when I woke in the morning, obviously she didn't do it. I don't know what happened to her, but she didn't do it. But I realized in the morning that I had reached a state of despair where I had attempted suicide the night before. And I had. She was the instrument, and it didn't work. And I woke up that morning, and I knew I was done. I was just done. There was nothing more that I could do there. I left the farm. I left my son. I left the dog. I left her. The only thing I had was my truck, an extra pair of jeans, an extra shirt, and my guitar. I don't know if I said my guitar. That's important. I had my guitar. And I left. I went back to Norman, Oklahoma. I just was done. I couldn't stay. And I knew it. You know, when I knew, I knew. It was just over. So I was homeless. You know, I had really managed myself into a state of homelessness, and done well at it. And and so when I got back up to Norman, Oklahoma, living in my truck, I found some friends who had just come out of a halfway house, an alcoholic, and I mean, who else am I going to find? So I moved in on their couch. And it was the most incredible time because we started in the morning with prayer and meditation. We would read from the big book. We would read from Al-Anon literature. I went to meetings every time the room opened. I went to open big book studies. I went to open AA meetings. I went to every Al-Anon meeting I could find. And I just dove in the program. And I loved it. I just loved it. And you kept talking to me about this thing called a sponsor. And that's fine. I'm glad you talk about a sponsor. But after about 3 months, this guy came through Al-Anon. And I don't know where he'd been hiding, but it was a man who had been attending Al-Anon. And I went up to him and I heard myself ask him, "Would you sponsor me?" And he said, "Sure." And he did. And so he said, the first thing he said was, "I want you to go home and write one thing for which you're grateful on a list." I'm going, "You want me to do what? Have you not been listening to me? I'm homeless. I've been..." And he said, "Yes, I want you to write one thing for which you're grateful." And so I went home and I thought and I thought and I thought. It really was hard. I couldn't think of anything to be grateful for. And so finally, I wrote, I'm grateful. I only have to write one damn thing on my gratitude list. And that's what I wrote. And I figured that when I took it back to him the next night, that would be the end of that exercise. He would realize the depth of my despair, whatever. And he said, Palmer, that's great. Now I want you to write two things. I was like, then it's three things. And then it was five things. And in the space of about 2 weeks, I found I was grateful. Nothing in my life had changed. I still had, well, I may have had some extra underwear then, by then, but I still had my jeans, my truck, my guitar. Nothing in my life had changed except my attitude. And I found that, I mean, it was an incredible lesson for me. All I have to do is listen to the instructions given to me by my sponsor and take the actions, and the feelings will follow. I didn't have to feel grateful to write a gratitude list. I wrote a gratitude list and began to feel grateful. Amazing lesson for me, and it has served me for a long time now in taking direction from a sponsor. He took me into the steps. And the first step wasn't, absolutely, I'm powerless over alcohol. Every time I get in the ring with alcohol or alcoholism, it just beats me to death. And I could understand that. I was reading this article way back in, I don't know, it was early 70s about this, the non-conference proof literature, but it was a guy it was in a newspaper. It was a guy in Russia who believed very strongly that if he would use 100% of his brain, he could do anything. And to demonstrate, he went out and stood in a freight train traffic, in front of a freight train, and he said, stop! And of course, he was run over and killed, but I was like that with alcoholism. Every time I'd get in the ring, I'd get knocked down. And so it wasn't hard for me to come to the point of saying, yes, I'm powerless over alcohol, and I certainly can't manage my life. I'd manage myself into a state of homelessness. And he took me to the second step. Now, the second step is kind of a left-handed admission that we're insane, and I didn't want to take that. I mean, I'm not insane, thank you very much. And he said, now, Palmer, tell me a minute, what was that tractor deal? And so, you know, I was like, okay, you know. And there were so many instances of what I had done was just insane behavior. And I knew that you guys were doing something different, and that whatever it was you were doing, I wanted what you had. And so it was okay for me to believe that, yeah, there's something in here which can restore me to sanity. I didn't have a problem with that. But then we got to the third step, and you know, I knew it was coming. I'd seen it on your walls, and I knew it. You know, and as this guy, I don't do God. Don't do God. Sorry. I was ready to walk out the door again because he wanted me to do this God thing. And my sponsor took me into the big book and the chapter of the agnostic. And it says that I suffer from a disease which only a spiritual experience and conquer. It says to be doomed to an alcoholic death or live on a spiritual basis are not easy alternatives to face. And you know, I'm doing this debate, do I want to go back and live with her, the knife, the tractor, or do I want to live on a spiritual basis? And I'm doing this debate, I'm not saying yet, you know, and then there's the kicker. It says, do you believe, or are you willing to believe in a power greater than yourself? And I got to tell you, I'm willing to believe because you've got something that I don't have. I want what you have, and I'm willing to do that. So he wanted me to get down on his knees, hold his hands, and say this third step prayer. I thought holding hands with a guy was a little excessive, but we did. And just, it's an amazing, amazing prayer. I love doing it with my guys now, you know. We kneel down, hold hands, and say the third step prayer together. And I love doing it. I love the prayer. I set it up here, you know. And I love that, relieve me of the bondage of self. Because it was self that was killing me over and over and over again. And he made me do a fourth step. And I could see that, you know, I was very confused, and I mean, very confused. I didn't know, you know, on the one hand, I'd say that I was at fault for everything that was going on the next sentence, I'd be saying, yeah, but she, yeah, but she, yeah, but she, yeah, but you don't understand. I just did what I did because she didn't. I was very confused. And so we did the fourth step. And I saw that, interestingly enough, that I had resentments for spread across the globe. Everybody I had this resentment about. And all of them came down to three or four of my character defects that caused me to have resentment. I saw my fears, and it was just an incredible experience. And so as I got through with my inventory, I realized that, you know, he wanted me to share it with him. And again, you know, I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to share with another human being that what I had done, because what I had done was so bad. It was so terrible that I knew that if I told anybody in the program what I had done, you would hold a group conscience and decide that, well, I know we let you in the door, but really, you're too far gone. We can't let you be in our room with us. And that's not what happened. He laughed and he said, yeah, I did that. You know, it's like, ah. And after we were done, he said, Palmer, I love you. In spite of everything that I'd done. I mean, I was a legend in my own mind. It was only so bad up here, you know, and he took me off the hook and it was okay. And I got to the sixth and seventh step. And somewhere when I was in the seventh step, I was in a room with about 10 people and I realized something is wrong. Something's wrong. And I stepped off to the side to see what it was. And what was wrong was that I was feeling absolutely comfortable with you. I was talking to 10 people, holding a conversation. And I'd never experienced that. I was comfortable in my own skin, and that hadn't happened before. And it was a result of the steps. While I was busy doing gratitude lists and inventories and other useless stuff, God had removed some of that fear from me. And so I was able to be amongst you. Most amazing feeling for me and a product of the steps. My sponsor left. He graduated at that time, I still don't know where he went. You know, he disappeared. Now he was in AA also, and I don't know if he got drunk or I don't know. Never found out. But I decided, you know, I've been around for 3 years. I'm pretty good. You know, I've got this thing down. I think I can probably sponsor myself and do a pretty good job. I know what I'm doing. And so I got my second sponsor. And I tell you, it is great when you sponsor yourself. I used to, you know, I don't want to go to a meeting tonight. I want to watch this TV show. And I'd discuss it with my sponsor. And my sponsor would say, sure, watch the TV show. And resentments are always good. I've got a resentment. And my sponsor would say, well, you should. You earned it here. You know? And I realized very quickly that I was just taking myself down. So I started looking for another sponsor. And another guy came through a meeting. He was in the sponsorship line that I knew. You know, I'd seen people and I resented what they were doing. And I hated what they were doing. And at the same time, I loved the recovery. And so I surrendered again and asked him to sponsor me. And we began the journey. And I went through the steps again. I got to the eighth step there's an Al-Anon piece of literature that says that we can do three lists. It says, you know, those we can easily make amends, those we might someday make amends, and those we're never, ever, ever going to make amends to. And of course, that doesn't work. My first wife was on that list of never, ever, ever, ever make amends to. And God laughs when we do that list. But I was able to sit down and make amends with her on the side of the road in Florida. The most amazing thing happened. I don't know what's going on with her. She may still hate me, and I don't know. But I know that when I went to make the amends, I was terrified. I mean, this was a woman that held a knife on me and a gun on me, and yet... when I made amends and continue to make amends, the fear was gone. The relationship was set right, and I no longer have any resentment or fear or anything except just kind love and compassion for her. I hope she does very well. It's a product of making amends. My mom was on the list. And I don't know how you make amends to somebody who'd been dead for many years. And I was listening to a friend of ours, Clint Hodges. Some of you may have heard Clint talk. He was he's no longer with us, but he was from California. And he was talking about how he'd had to make amends to his mom and write a letter and go to the grave and sit down and read. And I was talking to my sponsor about that, and he said, you know, I think that's a good idea. And so I wrote the letter and let him read it and made some changes. And I flew to New Mexico and went up to the cemetery. And I sat with my mom, and I cried, and I read, and I sat, and I cried. And I left the cemetery. This was one of those times where I did the deal. I didn't think it was going to work. I mean, it's like I had contempt prior to investigation, if you want to know the truth. But I did the deal. I came out of the cemetery, and the first person I ran into was my mom's dearest friend. And Becky said, Palmer, what were you doing today? And I said, I was just hanging out, Becky. She said, Palmer, what were you doing today? And I said, well, Becky, I was hanging out. I went to the cemetery. And she said, Palmer, what were you doing today? It was the most bizarre question. I mean, she kept drilling. She wouldn't let it go. And I said, well, Becky, I had abandoned mom dying of cancer and left to go to Virginia Beach. I was selfish and self-centered. And I needed to make amends to her, so I sat with her and wrote a letter. And Becky started laughing. It's not what I expected. She said, Palmer, I was with your mother the day that you left, and she was overjoyed that you were going to Virginia. She did not want you to see her dying of cancer. I don't know what the odds are that I'm going to take an action that I don't think is going to work, and I'm going to come out of the canyon, Waukee Pines Canyon, and be set free from a guilt that I'd carried for 30 years. There's only a loving God working in my life that can organize that. I am so grateful for that today. People call me, I was at a meeting saying something, I don't know what I was saying, but this lady came up afterward and said, you're part of the God Squad. I don't think she meant it as a compliment, but I said, I said, thank you. I think it is so improbable that when I came in the program, I'm the one saying, no, 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 I don't do God, I don't do this thing. And yet, as a process of going through the steps, the natural thing is that we develop a relationship with a God that we may or may not understand, and I certainly have. Today, I know that there is a loving God working personally in my life. I know it. I was in Norman while I was still attending school. I was just about finishing my bachelor's degree, and I started dating this gal, and we began a courtship, and we really did. And after a little over a year, we got married. Now, she was an earth girl. She didn't need a program. She didn't understand why I went to Al-Anon. She was okay that I went, but she didn't understand it. And so after a year, we got married. And we went off on our honeymoon. And I noticed on the honeymoon, gosh, she drinks a lot. And indeed, she did. She's one of those women in the big book that go downhill very fast. And in a very short time, she was drinking alcoholically. My sponsor laughs at me and he says, you know, Palmer, most times we don't cause it, can't cure it, and can't control it. But we're going to make an exception in your case. You're a carrier. You infected her. So we began the dance again, you know, with alcoholism. And, and, And yet, this time it was different. This time I had a program. I had a sponsor. I was going to meetings. And it's very different dealing with alcoholism from the perspective of having a program. I mean, there were days that I had to go into the trash can to see if she really only had two beers. But, yeah, right. But I didn't have to do that much. And so, you know, I was able to come home and find her in the passed out in the backyard or on the floor and whatever and just cover up with a blanket and go to bed. I was able to do that with serenity. And I came home one day and my dog wouldn't let me alone, kept taking me upstairs and leading me upstairs and wouldn't let me not go upstairs. And so I finally gave in and surrendered and walked upstairs. And she was dead in the bathroom, and I had to kick the door down, and she wasn't dead. She was passed out from a mixture of alcohol and drugs and an attempted, written something on the mirror and lipstick. And I called the ambulance, and they came and hauled her to the emergency room and put her on a breathing machine. It was different because this time I called you, I called my tribe, I called my sponsor, and you came in and were loving on me and taking care of me. And I noticed again as I was in the emergency room, if we back up a minute to when I was in the commune, you know, hippies used to talk about love, we love you. And one time in this moment of honesty, I'd said, you know, I don't feel it. I don't feel loved. And they picked me up. Literally, and were holding me, rocking me, and I was alone and lonesome, apart from. There's something in me that was broken, and yet when I was in the emergency room waiting, the waiting area of critical care, my tribe was in there, Al-Anons and AAs holding me and rocking me, and I was loved and I knew it. Something again had been fixed in me while I was looking over here, and I was capable of being loved and loving. Most amazing thing, again, a gift of the steps. My wife came out and she decided she wanted to go to AA, so I was able to take her to a meeting because I was going to a meeting and put her hand in y'all's hand and turn around and go to my meeting. Because I know that I'm not the one that can carry the message to her. I just can't fix her. And so I went to my meeting, and she started going to meeting, and she put together a year of sobriety. And something happened. I mean, you know, life happens, even if we're in the program. And something, an event happened that was just so devastating that she started drinking again, and she couldn't stop. And it's amazing, you know. There came a point when she had no defense against the first drink because she had not enlarged upon her spiritual condition. I mean, that's her story, not mine. But she started drinking again, and in a month and a half, she was back on a breathing machine again, and I didn't know whether she'd live or die. It's an amazing thing to watch that happen, and I understand that it is a disease. I understand that from observing. I don't have that, but I understand that phenomenon of craving. And once she took a drink, she was off and running and could not stop. She came out and she kept trying and couldn't stop. And I just kept doing what I was doing. I was going to school. I had graduated with my bachelor's. Amazing thing, you know, the stupid one in the family. Got a bachelor's in education, and I could go teach. And I did. I was teaching. And the chair of the department came and he said, we want you to take this test Saturday. I said, okay. So I went and took a test Saturday, and it happened to be the GRE. And I came back, and he said, well, you passed pretty well. We'd like to offer you a fellowship to go to graduate school. Like, what? And he says, wants you to go to graduate school. And so I was thinking, you know, I was way up in my 30s. I'm too old to go to graduate school. And Clint Hodges again was talking, and he said he had been offered a trip to law school, and he went to his sponsor, and he said, do you know how old I'll be in 4 years if I go to law school? And Clancy looked at him and said, well, tell me, Clint, how old will you be in 4 years if you don't go to law school? I'm so glad for sponsorship. I would not have thought of that. I need things broken down very simply. And so that I went to graduate school. And so I started one day at a time, one test at a time, one class at a time, one paper at a time, for going through graduate school. And I remember one time calling my sponsor, and I said, I was whining, quality whining, but I was whining. And they want me to write a whole book to get out of here, and then I can't do that. And he said, well, Palmer, have you written the first page yet? I said, well, no. And he said, why don't you write the first page? And so again, one page at a time, applying these principles to my life, I took them out. And I graduated with a PhD in chemistry from the University of Oklahoma. You understand, you're clapping for you. There's no way that I can do that. There's not a road from under the bridge, my pickup where I was living, to being a PhD in chemistry. There's not a road from there to there, except through the grace of God as operating through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon, who took me across that gap. It doesn't happen. People don't go from there to there. And so I'm grateful. I got out of the University of Oklahoma and I got a job offer from a university in Florida, in Miami, Florida. So I went to Florida, and I am today on the faculty of a university in Miami. I don't know how that happens. I just know that you know, when I did the seventh step, I asked God to remove this defect of character, caretaking. You know, I'm a caretaker. God didn't remove it from me. He just gave me a job as a caretaker. It says somewhere in our literature that in God's hands, our defects become our greatest assets. And so today, all I do is I take care of God's kids, and it is an incredible job. It's incredible. You know, I know that I'm one of God's kids. I know that you are, because if you're not, I'm not, and I am, so you are. And as are these kids. And so I go to work. The state of Florida thinks I work for them, but they're mistaken. I work for God. You know, I just get up every day and I say, what can I do for God? What can I do for you and your kids today? And it is an amazing life. And the kids don't understand that I'm practicing these principles in all my affairs. They think I'm a neat guy or something. You know, they don't know. They don't know that it is God directing me daily to do what I do. My wife came. She couldn't sober up. Could not sober up. She says she has enough white chips to tile the bathroom floor. And she's right. I mean, you know, and one Thanksgiving, we had our kids down and we were going to prepare a turkey and all the fixings for Thanksgiving. And she got drunk and passed out. And I went ahead and finished dinner and, you know, what wasn't burned. And if you believe it, I had a resentment. You know, I had to call my sponsor on Thanksgiving. You know what she did? She got, she came stumbling in halfway through dinner and scratched around on plate a little, you know, but she didn't want to eat. But she did sober up shortly thereafter. And we were sharing as a couple in a meeting, anniversary meeting, and she was relating this story about one Thanksgiving she had burned the turkey, and she felt so ashamed that was her moment of clarity. And she went back with a renewed vigor to Alcoholics Anonymous and sobered up. You know, that taught me something. You know, here, the event that I had prayed for and had longed for that would sober her up came along, and I didn't see it. I thought it was an event that I should resent and that it was wrong. I found that I don't know what's best for me. If I think something's good for me, very often it's bad for me. If I think it's bad for me, it may very well be the best thing that could happen for me and to me and with me. And I don't know what's best. My sponsor is real big about talking about, you know, why don't we just let it unfold today, Palmer? There is a God and I'm not God. And when I remember that principle, life is really amazing. You know, my life is very full and incredibly busy. There's a lot that happens. But yet, when I just do one thing at a time and do that, it all just flows so smoothly. And today, my life is quiet and serene. There's not all this chatter in my brain going on that I can't hear anything because of all the voices in my head, the committee. That's a gift from you, the program. I was reading through my big book as I was thinking today, and I found a letter from one of my students. I just want to share part of it because it's God. God working in our lives. So I had my interview with the pre-med committee last Friday, and they are highly recommending me to the medical schools. I'm so excited that I'm getting closer to med school. This has caused me to stop and just say thank you to you, my mentor. Thank you for making such an impact on my life for the first two semesters and for writing all those wonderful letters, et cetera, et cetera. I could have missed it all. I could have missed it all. When I came struggling in the door to you, all I wanted was for her to stop drinking and for my brain to shut down and to know, I mean, I didn't know what I wanted. Had I got what I wanted the day I first came to you, I would never have gotten this letter. Because this is what God has done for me and through me as a result of taking actions that I didn't believe would work. But I trust my sponsor, I trust you, and I trust the process. I was at a funeral for a very dear friend of mine. Her father had died, and I was there to support her. And as I was there, I was listening to the minister, and he talked about grace. And I was reflecting on that when I got home, and I realized, I don't understand. I don't know what grace means. So I went to a piece of non-conference-approved literature, the Webster's Dictionary. I know, it's what I had, so... And it says that grace is unmerited divine assistance given man for his sanctification and regeneration. It's unmerited. I don't know. I didn't do anything to earn this. It's available for anybody who just opens their hands and accepts it. It's kind of like a radio signal. All you got to do is turn on and twist the dial or press the button. This is digital age and go to the right frequency. You know, all we have to do is just receive it. I understand that. I didn't do anything to earn it. I understand regeneration. I certainly have been made anew because I am not anything that I thought I should be or would be. I didn't know what sanctification meant, so I went back to the S's, and it says sanctification is to be set free. That's what you have done for me, is you have set me free through everything that you have given me. You know, God, through you, because I need God in human skin, have set me free. Thank you for my life.
Thank you, Palmer.